here's the reality. Some people feel the need to be reconciled to God. And that's God's work. But there are others who will rise in anger at the mere mention that they should submit their will or their desires to someone greater than they are. And as a culture moves farther away from God, the more violent their reaction will become. And your faith will be tested in this. Friends, you can, and indeed you must, endure.
You're listening to Opening the Bible with Dr. Nick Gatzke, Senior Pastor of Old North Church in Canfield, Ohio. I'm your host, Brian Dolan. Today we get to part one of a message in our series on the book of 2 Corinthians. It's called Strength to Endure. And that word endure evokes a lot of imagery, I think, in our minds. And you know, for a lot of people who just listen to the show or sit in the pews at church, they don't see the pain that people are in, where that word endure would come up. Can you help paint a picture of what it's really like in the ministerial side of things? Like, what are people struggling with in everyday life?
Yeah, endurance is so needed because life is really hard. And life is really hard for all of the reasons you might imagine and many more. Personal toil and struggle. People who struggle in jobs that they hate but can't find another way to provide for their family. People who have been riddled with insecurity for any variety of reasons over the years and are always trying to figure out where they fit, what their value and worth is, and how that relates to the situation around them. And the list goes on and on and on, from illness to death to family members who struggle to kids who have rebelled against their parents or kids who have rebelled against the Lord, and on down the line.
So then all the people that seemingly fake it on Sunday are really faking it? Is that what you're saying? I mean, because we all have to endure in some measure.
Everybody has to endure in some measure. And, you know, I think it's incredibly cynical that you think everybody fakes it. And yet at the same time, most of us are pretty good at putting on a facade, putting on a shield, pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps and just doing the next thing, which in some ways might feel fake to others. And in other instances, is actually the evidence of endurance, that we don't wallow in self-pity, that we keep moving forward, and that we cling to the Lord as we do.
Well, we got to learn more about endurance. I know I sure do. Let's listen into today's message. It's part one in a two-part sermon called Strength to Endure.
At its root, our relationship with God could be categorized in one of two ways, by either rebellion or by reconciliation. Those are the root categories, rebellion or reconciliation, rebellion that is rooted in sin or reconciliation that is rooted in God's grace. And that rebellion that is rooted in sin can take on a lot of different forms in our life, can it? As you think about how you have related with God over the years, I think about the father who had a very strong-willed son. On the way to the store, he kept telling the child, sit down and buckle your seatbelt. But the little kid just kept standing on his seat in the back. And again, he would say, sit down and buckle your seatbelt. Can any parent relate? Of course you can. And after a time or two more, the child finally sat down. He figured that if he didn't, disaster would strike. And so he slipped down into his seat and he snapped the seatbelt closed and he said, Daddy, I'm sitting down on the outside, but I'm still standing up on the inside. A spirit of rebellion. And that is such an apt picture of some of our rebellion against God. It looks good. How we act and what we do looks good on the outside, but on the inside, there's still this rage of rebellion to do our own thing that's happening. For some of us, our rebellion against God is much more explicit in its nature. I think about the fine Christian doctor who had a boy named Keith. And Keith was an intellectual and he graduated high school at the top of his class. But his father began to sense some seeds of rebellion in his son and an unwillingness to respond to his counsel. Keith wanted to go to Stanford University. And since they lived in the Southwest region, that was possible, but it meant a significant outlay of money for the family. So Keith was told what it would mean and that he would have to work to help with his expenses. He reluctantly agreed and said he would, and off he went to Stanford. While at Stanford, he never got a job. But he did get fed with all of that gunk from the secular world about parents and how terrible it is to be in submission to them. And so he went back home after that first year during the summer, and he announced to his father that he was taking off. Big mistake. His dad said, "Okay, son, I'll tell you what. Everything that you think you have, I bought for you and for your use." The boy played the violin beautifully. So the father said, "That Stradivarius violin, you leave that in my home." And the boy kind of gulped and blinked and said, "Okay." And then he said, "By the way, that new car that you drove to school last year, that's mine, so make sure you leave it in the garage." "Okay. And the clothes hanging in your closet, I bought them all. Leave them there." "The clothes?" the son said. "Yeah, all the clothes. You may leave with the clothes that you have on you and with the shoes that you're wearing. And also, that money in your pocket was the money that I gave you last week. Go ahead and leave it on the counter before you leave. And let me see, is there anything else I'm not thinking of?" And the boy, now trembling, said, "No, Dad, I think you've picked everything that there is." And the father said, "Okay, you can leave." Who broke the relationship? Who rebelled? Was it the father who took everything away, or the son who wanted to go on his own way? Of course, it was the son. He not only insulted the father, but then rebelled against him. And as a result, the father withheld all the good things that he had allowed the boy to use. That evening, of course, they sat down. They had a long talk, eyeball to eyeball, and the very wise father leveled with the young rebel. And today, they have a relationship that's something to behold. But friends, that's a picture of explicit rebellion. And whether your rebellion against God at some point in your life was implicit in its nature, that rebellion of the heart, or explicit in its actions, we know that our relationship with God can be defined by either rebellion or reconciliation. And as we turn to our text this morning in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, we see the continuation of this exhortation given in chapter 5. And the exhortation is very clear and very direct and very bold. It is this: be reconciled to God. And so with that, follow with me as we read 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 to 13. This is what Paul writes. He says, "Working together with him," that's us, working together with God, "then we appeal to you not to receive the grace of God in vain. For he says, 'In a favorable time, I listened to you, and in a day of salvation, I have helped you. Behold, now is the favorable time, and behold, now is the day of salvation. We put no obstacle in anyone's way so that no fault may be found with our ministry. But as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, by great endurance, in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labors, sleepless nights, hunger, by purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, the Holy Spirit, genuine love, by truthful speech and the power of God, with the weapons of righteousness for the right hand and for the left, through honor and dishonor, through slander and praise. We are treated as impostors and yet are true, as unknown and yet well known, as dying, and behold, we live, as punished and yet not killed, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing, as poor yet making many rich, as having nothing yet possessing everything. We have spoken freely to you, Corinthians. Our heart is wide open. You are not restricted by us, but you are restricted in your own affections. In return, I speak as to children, widen your heart also. When you see a passage like this in the New Testament and you see lists of qualities and characteristics and actions, sometimes it's hard to break down exactly the main thrust of what Paul is getting at. You see in the beginning of this text, verses 1 and 2, a bridge from the previous section. If you were to look at chapters 5 and 6 together, you would see this big, clear, blinking sign that says, be reconciled to God. Above all else, know that God is reconciling the world to himself, and you have the opportunity to be reconciled to him. That in the state of rebellion or separation from God, that God is working in this incredibly powerful way through the work of Jesus on the cross to forgive you of your sin and to make you a new creation, that you would no longer live for yourself, but rather you would live for the one who created you, and you would not be defined by your sin, but you would be called the righteousness of God. Wow. That's incredible that God would look at you and say, that person is a picture of my righteousness. And that's the opportunity that you have. That's the opportunity that I have. And here in verse 1 of chapter 6, he reminds us that we can work together with God in this opportunity. Not that you or I work to be reconciled to God. That's God's work. He's doing the reconciliation work. But once you are reconciled, you have the opportunity to work with God in that ministry of reconciliation to other people. That's what we talked about a few weeks ago in chapter 5. He uses the phrase of an ambassador, a diplomatic official that is sent to a foreign land on a mission. That's what an ambassador does. And that's what you Christians do because you're not home. Not yet. You're living in a place that's not your home. But you have the opportunity to be an ambassador for the one who is sovereign over this place and your home. And so, that's the work of the apostle, and that's the work of the Christian. And you have two opportunities, opportunity to be reconciled to God and opportunity to be an ambassador of God to this world. And that's what he means when he quotes Isaiah in verse 2 there. He says, in a favorable time, I listened to you, said God, and in the day of salvation, I have helped you. And Paul says, behold, now is the favorable time. Now is the day of salvation. Now is the day. Don't wait any longer. And so, when you see that as the backdrop, and the big message of this section of the book, be reconciled to God, opportunity number one, opportunity number two, be an ambassador for God once you are reconciled. When you look at the charge of verse 1, you have to pause for a minute because it might feel like it's a little bit out of place in the midst of this incredible work that God is doing. He says in verse 1, we appeal to you not to receive the grace of God in vain. If God is doing this incredible thing, then how could you possibly receive it in vain? What's the danger here? How could this massive grand plan of God appear to be hijacked? For something to be in vain means, literally in the New Testament Greek, it means that it's empty or it has no value or no effectiveness. To say that the grace of God is in vain in your life would mean that it has no lasting value to you and no effect in you and on you for how you navigate the days. So, what would display God's grace to be in vain in your life? What would paint that picture? And the answer is if you do not continue in it or endure in this new life that God has given you, then it would appear that God's grace would be seen to be in vain. This is a call to endurance. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 points us back to the wonderful grace of God and points us forward to the endurance that is required to live in it. You can remember a musical artist that was a one-hit wonder. It was like lightning in a bottle, man. They had that one song, and then every song after that just seemed to fall a little flat. They appeared to be one thing, and they were something else. Or the rookie of the year. That rookie year was amazing, and within a year or two, they were out of the league. Or that flash in the pan, to use another colloquialism, maybe at your job. Somebody comes in and they are hot, man. They are on fire for what they're doing professionally. And within a year or two, nobody even remembers their name. What do those things have in common? They all look like one thing at the beginning, but they end up to be something completely different at the end. And the message of endurance is one that says, look like one thing at the beginning when you receive the grace of God or acknowledge Him as the King and continue on in it all the way to the end. To endure means the ability to sustain prolonged stress or difficulty without degradation or impairment. Let me say it again because it's really important. What does it mean to endure in something? It means life is hard. You can sustain stress and difficulty, but you will not be diminished in it or impaired by it. You can function at 100% even if the circumstances around you are infinitely more difficult than they were 2 weeks ago. That's what it means to endure. And in verses 3 through 10, we see four different aspects of this endurance that is applied to the life of the apostle and by extension applied to the life of you and me. And so look at it with me. In verses 4 and 5, we see this endurance in the gospel is an endurance in trouble. Paul lists the things that he had to endure: afflictions, hardships, calamities. You might call these the general great troubles of his time. I don't need to tell you that life is hard, that you will undergo difficulties that you cannot plan for, that you do not expect. That is the reality of the human situation for every single one of us. Jesus, in fact, tells his disciples in John 16:33, in this world, you will have tribulation, but take heart. I have overcome the world. Paul lists troubles from others, beatings, imprisonments, and riots. Because, you know, here's the reality. Some people feel the need to be reconciled to God. God has softened their hearts. He's opened their eyes. He's given them a spiritual desire or inkling to continue to pursue Him or be reconciled to Him. And that's God's work. But there are others who will rise in anger at the mere mention that they should submit their will or their desires to someone greater than they are. And as our culture moves farther away from God, the more violent their reaction will become. And your faith will be tested in this, whether or not you endure in those instances. Paul had to endure beatings, imprisonment, and riots. Some of us look at ourselves in the mirror and examine our own thoughts and minds, and we say, I might be that strong to endure that. And others of us perhaps wonder if we can even endure basic scorn and reputational damage. But friends, you can, and indeed you must endure. Paul lists what we might call some troubles of work, labors, sleepless nights, hunger. When the work needs to be done, when people are perishing without knowing the Lord, when the urgency is high, when there is this dual motivation of a fear of the judgment seat of Christ for them and of the love of Christ that is compelling us to serve them. You press hard. You endure stress. Heartache is real. You skip meals. You stay awake at night in prayer, and you do so for the sake of other people and for the love of the Lord, and you endure in this. All of these hardships that Paul mentions are hardships that we have to endure. They are the hardships for the apostle, but they are the hardships that you might just have in this life. And the call is to endure. Friends, those broad categories of hardships are real. I think they're careful in the way that they're applied to him and maybe applied to you. But I think the thing that we lose in this passage, if we don't pause and continue to come back to it again, is the reality for each and every one of you that there's going to be some real things that tempt you to turn away from God in this life. I mean, let's just say it. It is what it is. There's going to be, and we're going to come back to this in a minute, but there's going to be some real things, some really hard things in this world that are going to cause you to question him, that are going to make you wonder if it's worth it. And that's why the message to endure is so important. How do you do that? Well, verses 6 and 7, Paul points us to the source of endurance that we need. He mentions that the source of this endurance is what we might call spirit-given graces. He gives a list of them. And the list has one surprise in it. One of these things is not like the other. Let's see if you can pick it out. Purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, the Holy Spirit, and genuine love. The entire list relates to a combination of disposition and a state of being that has action associated to it. All of them, except for one. The Holy Spirit is just plopped down right there in the middle of these different graces. The Holy Spirit plays the vital role in helping you endure the difficulties of life and gospel work. The Holy Spirit gives you supernatural power to receive the grace of the Father through the sacrifice of the Son, but not just to receive that grace, but to continue in it so that grace is not given in vain. And we might say that all of these other things are stated dispositions, and they're graces of the Holy Spirit in your life. These things reflect an inward reality. They all point to the fact that the gospel work in you is continuing to form. As you continue to grow in the Lord and navigate life, these graces will indeed continue to grow in you, and you will have the disposition that is contrary to the disposition you have before when you seek resistance. It points to the fact that gospel work isn't revenge business. How do you respond, or what is your natural instinct when you are devoting yourself to something of importance and effectiveness and people rise up against you, but you succeed anyway? If you're anything like me, your instinct is to say, "Ha! I gotcha! I told you so! I'll show you! Don't rise up in that way against what I'm doing. It's too great. It's too important. It's too significant. And you're wrong, and I'm right." But the graces of the Holy Spirit do not compel us toward emotional or social revenge. No matter how bad we want it, the Spirit compels us toward purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, and genuine love, even in the midst of opposition, slander, difficulty, and even in the midst of persecution.
That wraps up another message from Dr. Nick Gatzke here on Opening the Bible. And I want to bring Pastor Gatzke back in as our resource this month for A Gift to Opening the Bible. It might seem like a heavy book in that it deals with sorrow and loss, but I'd imagine that you experience this regularly in your congregation.
Loss is part of life, and grief and pain are part of the common experiences of all humans. And so to have a resource like this that helps us to think about how God works in the midst of our difficulty, I think can be immensely helpful and really encouraging to people.
How can you cling to comfort from the Lord in the midst of such a difficult loss? Well, Tim Challies talks all about it in Seasons of Sorrow, and this resource could be yours with a gift this month to Opening the Bible. How do you get that gift in? Go to openingthebible.org. That's openingthebible.org. Opening the Bible is a teaching ministry of and is sponsored by Old North Church of Canfield, Ohio.